Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thunder, Flitz, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Now, a few weeks ago, you may have heard my interview with artist Arthur Ransom, which was stretched across two episodes. I personally found it absolutely fascinating to sit down with him and chat about his life and work on things like Looking, Anderson, Side Vision, Button Man, and Maze World. But I also wanted an opportunity not just to revisit some of the themes and ideas that we touched on in that interview, but also to get some outside perspectives on Arthur's work, because I think, personally, as you may have heard from the interview, I think it's work that really rewards a second glance and an in-depth dive. So I'm very pleased that Ben Smith, who's the head of books and comic books at Rebellion Publishing, Graham McMillan, who writes for The Hollywood Reporter and is a big fan of Arthur's work, John Freeman from the Down the Tubes website, and also photographer Ellen Rogers, who knows and has been influenced by Arthur and his work. Absolutely fascinating discussion that really got into the nitty-gritty of what makes his artwork so unique and so influential as well, far beyond the pages of 2000 AD. Before we plunge into the chat with Ben, Graham, John and Ellen, I want to remind you that you can keep up to date on the latest 2000 AD news by joining the 2000 AD Thrill Mail, which goes out every Wednesday. Just go along to 2000ad.com/thrillmail, that's all one word, and sign up there and you'll get a weekly thrill blast into your inbox with all the latest news and announcements. So we've got stuff about the comics, we've got stuff about merchandise. You also get free comics when you sign up, which is a pretty good deal. Also, if you've enjoyed the Arthur Ransom podcast, and indeed any of the interviews that we've done on the Thrillcast, then if I could prevail upon your kindness to go and rate and review us at iTunes or the podcast app of your choice, it all helps the algorithm to put 2000 AD's Thrillcast in front of more eyes and spread the gospel of thrill power to the masses. So it'd be very much appreciated. Thank you. So, we're here to talk about Arthur Ransom, and as I said, sat down with Ben Smith, Graham McMillan, John Freeman and Ellen Rogers. You'll pick up who is who as we go along, as we examine and talk about the impact and legacy of Arthur Ransom's unique style and some of the incredible stories he's brought to us over the last 40 odd years. So we are bringing out a new collection of Maze World later this year, yeah. Which is even in terms of 2008, it's a very overlooked work, because originally there was a little bit of a fan campaign to get it back into print. Not many people know about this. Why have we chosen Maze World in particular to reprint in a special collector's edition?
Oh, well, the opportunity, really. So we did an edition of Maze World about close to 10 years ago, maybe not quite. It's a perennial seller. It's interesting. It's not a famous work in the way that other things have been, and I think in terms of Arthur's work for 2000 AD, Shambhala probably is the one that kind of casts a shadow, the greatest shadow. But Maze World is, as anybody who knows who's ever seen any of the pages, is just a remarkable work without any kind of similar. Although 2000 AD has done fantasy and other stories over the years, there's nothing like Maze World. It's kind of it's in a genre all of its own, which I won't even attempt to define. And so consequently, when we looked at what we had coming up and what had sold through, Maze World, although it had never roared off in any kind of great shakes, is a continual seller over time. And so we realised that we needed to put out a new edition, but B, really needed to find a way to give that artwork a greater scale, so publishing it at a larger size, and really see if we can't get this time around the conversation started about it, that they really should be there. I mean, it's interesting because it's in translation in multiple countries, and Arthur's work in actually over the past, I would say, 3 to 4 years, Arthur's work has suddenly found this blossoming in France. All the Button Man books have had incredible traction. The books are now out in Spain as well. There's Dutch editions of things coming. Interestingly, over the last 2 or 3 years, I mean, Alan Grant's work is superb as well, but Arthur Ranson's artwork across all of his different stories is really, really beginning to find traction. I'm so delighted that we can share that with him.
I mean, for you, what are the qualities of Arthur's work that really make it special, that make it unique?
Oh, well, I mean, I found Arthur with not through from Lookin or things like that, but from Button Man in the prog, and it looked like nothing else. It's a cliche to say it looked real in a way that other things didn't, but it absolutely did, and it's just gripping for being so. And just the it's easy to fall into the trap of just talking about his remarkable penmanship and the way he brings things to life, but his storytelling is absolutely superb, and so he for me is another one of those artists who've become really known through 2000 AD just because they're not like anybody else. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there are people who try and do photo real. There are people who draw over the top of photographs and things like that, but there's nobody who's done the body of work that Arthur has, that he stands alone on that pedestal.
Graham, I want to come on to you on this, because you work for the States, or you live in the States, you work for things like the Hollywood Reporter. You're very involved in what's going on in the comics industry at the time. Why do you think an artist like Arthur Ranson is so overlooked, when there always seems to be such an incredible reaction to his artwork?
Well, his stuff is very outside of the American comic mainstream. He's much more filmic in that approach, in a time when Jack Kirby was the norm, and Jack Kirby sort of left the stage and set things up for the way that American comics look. Arthur's stuff is very different and very much more informed by other media.
Well, that's interesting, because of course his career formed at Lookin, where he was doing tie-in TV work like Sapphire and Steel, and even things like Dane. I mean, he talked about it on the podcast the other week. You know, he got an award from Cosgrove Hall because of his work on Danger Mounts. I mean, when you have an age of the comics auteur, when you have people lauded for their past career, Ranson still seems like a strange omission. You know, when there is appreciation of European comics in the States, isn't there?
There is, and I think honestly that Arthur is due his time. I was looking over Button Man, which is getting the Get Harry X reissue soon. Looking over Maze World, there's so much that he does that is now visible in other artists in American comics, but he was doing it 20, 30 years ago. I think that this is going to be a point where people are going to look at him and really appreciate what he does.
John, I want to come to you to talk a little bit about Lookin, because I don't know if you heard the interview that I did with him, where he talked about his influences, you know, people like Toppy, European comics, things like that. Lookin was a unique training ground for an artist like Arthur, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the most incredible thing about Arthur Ranson and Angus Allen's partnership on Lookin isn't just actually the artwork, though. Obviously, the Beatles story, the Elvis, where I first got introduced to Arthur's work is Sapphire and Steel, which is just stunning. Even that one of his earlier strips, but the fact that those two guys went to the Junior TV Times guys and said, "We want to own the rights to the Beatles," back in the 1970s, is just brilliant, you know. And the same with Elvis, that they managed to hold on to that on others. Their groundbreaking. I mean, Lookin is very underrated, and if you read there's an interview with Angus Allen online about how badly they were treated by the industry because it was seen, and Arthur mentioned it in his interview with you, about how it sort of people looked down their noses at Lookin, but it was selling bucket loads a week compared with other titles, and it was no wonder that the BBC tried to compete. It's a fantastic title.
It's an interesting parallel with today, isn't it? That so many people look down on the comics that populate the newsstand now. You know, everyone complains. Well, they've all got bits of plastic tat stuck to their covers and all that. You know, they just license their tie-in, things like that. But of course, as you say, you know, this was an incredible training ground for artists and incredibly popular. So it seems to hit something that what we think of the comics mainstream don't really appreciate.
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, I think you can certainly appreciate the artwork. Certainly, but when you've got people like Mike Noble, Arthur Ranson, I think Bill Titcomb to a certain extent, although perhaps his better work was on TV comic in the 60s and on TV 21, where he did My Favourite Martian, for example, and things like that.
You had John Burns in Look In as well, didn't you?
John and Burns, of course. Yeah, that strip, his Bionic Woman strip, is absolutely fantastic, and I don't think it's been reprinted anywhere. The major problem, I think, is that it's a bit like Mazewell getting it now being seen again, thanks to you guys doing the new edition. But there's no visibility for any of the work that was in Look In. I don't think any of it's been reprinted, partly because some of the rights holders aren't keen on seeing the material reprinted because it's out, and some of it is very of its time. Obviously the music strips of the looking are probably something you may well be looking at in their entirety because they're great. I mean, Colin Shelbourne is still floating around out there somewhere. I spoke to him when I did the Beatles story for an audio comic prior to you guys taking me on. There's so much material out there that people just not seen, and hopefully, you know, things like when Arthur's work gets exposed through Mazeworld, it may lead, you know, to other things, other more of his work. Perhaps somebody looking at his other work. It's a bit like when somebody gets the film rights to one of their comics, and then one of the films gets made, as I'm sure Graham will testify. If one of them gets made, suddenly there are studios at the door wanting to do all the rest of their work. Mm. So, you know, it's a possible. Hopefully, that's the same with Arthur.
With something like Arthur's work along, because we touched on this in the interview, how he felt incredibly lucky to have had all this work, because he was looking for quite a substantial period of time, and then just as it was about to go under, he made the leap to 2000 AD, and he expressed his happiness at having been able to have been part of that moment and not been swept away as British comics, by and large, the industry that had existed collapsed. I mean, in terms of what you think, John, how fortunate are we to have given somebody like Arthur that opportunity?
Totally. I mean, 2000 AD is still regarded as a survivor of the British comic market, even though there are a lot of comics and titles aimed at younger readers. And so it was a perfect opportunity. I mean, there wasn't another British publisher that was doing the same thing that 2000 AD was at the same time. I mean, obviously, Marvel UK were hoping to do similar things to 2000 AD. Richard Starkings, for example, certainly was pushing for that with things like Dragon's Claws, Knights of Pendragon. But Marvel UK management was reticent until Paul Neary arrives and does the Genesis 1992 project after Richard Starkings had moved on and gone to the States. By which time, you know, that people would have been waiting around for work, and a lot of people, when things began to dry up, moved into the games, into the world of designing games. Dermot Power, for example, he, as well as doing stuff for Marvel UK, he did for Digitech for Marvel UK, he was doing game stuff as well, even then, I believe. Mm. Yes, I mean, 2000 AD has provided a platform for so many great talents in the invidious position of being last comic standing of its kind. but that's not to its detriment in any way. You know, it's certainly, you know, there just wasn't anything of that. Well, not in the UK. Although, I mean, obviously, I would have said that Arthur's work is perfect for the European market. But looking at his credits, he doesn't seem to have ever managed to quite catch the them in the same way that Pat Mills did with his writing.
Yeah, no, I think that that's changing now. I mean, Rebellion have been kind of responsible for taking, handling the foreign rights stuff and being kind of more aggressively taking things out to Angoulême and to Frankfurt and the rest of it. And certainly Arthur's work has been one of the creators who's been, you know, people have really, really responded to. And those French editions of Button Man look spectacular. And I know they've had rave reviews over there. So I think Arthur's moment is only going to continue to build, really, in terms of international recognition.
I want to come to Alan because, like I said, you're not just a friend of Arthur's, but he's somebody who's influenced you in your own work in photography. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you came into contact with Arthur's work?
Oh, hi. So I went to buy some of Arthur's artwork because it was so influential to me at the time. I was kind of always looking, as a young girl, I was always looking for girls who were involved in action but weren't necessarily wearing high heels, or they were able to do a great deal. So I kind of found that in May's World and in the Anderson stories, and I really wanted to just see how he was colouring, because I was working in black and white photography and I was kind of colouring and looking to do it in the same way as he was. And he's also kind of dealing with not only kind of people on a working class level. Often there'd be people like in jails telling their stories and things like that, which really appealed to me outside of the superhero genre, but also kind of like spiritual themes as well. So I was always very drawn to the idea of him kind of showing other cultures within a British culture. That's how I came to him.
What were the qualities of Arthur's work that drew you to it? You know, not just in terms of the story, but in terms of how it looked, like things like composition.
Yeah, so I'm actually looking at one of the pictures right now, and everything is so fluid, and it's so kind of within a dream logic, I think, particularly May's World, which was always massively influential to me. Because I wanted to be able to create this kind of other world, parallel, very familiar, but also completely fantastical. And his colouring just exemplifies that. Everything is very washed out because he's using watercolour, but at the same time, it's really, really punchy. And somehow I have a lot of the original artwork, and I can actually see it replicated in the comics that you're putting out at the moment. I can see the colours are maintained. So it was really kind of... It was compositional, kind of when I was putting things together in the darkroom, trying to kind of emulate some of this stuff in my early stages. But really, it was colouring that kind of really jumped out to me, and the way women were rendered.
Just on that point, I wanted to come back to John, because the use of colour, something we touched on in the interview, he was very fortunate at the time when he was working on Looking to be working in colour, because the vast majority of comic books were black and white, but Looking was kind of the top end of the market. So you look at his Sapphire and Steel stuff, and like Ellen says, the palettes are muted but not dour. It's incredible.
Yeah, and you've also got the advantage, of course, that Looking was on a glossier paper than a lot of the... perhaps because it was a TV title and it was considered the junior TV Times, it's on a better quality paper than a lot of the British comics, which were on what we would nicely call bog paper, and therefore doesn't have the same sort of hasn't lasted. If you like, they were very immediate British comics, and you read them and they were gone for a lot of people. Whereas Looking and the predecessors of the same ilk, Countdown, going back to TV 21, going back to Eagle, Swift, those papers that have that higher quality paper seem to have survived. Although strangely, when 2000 AD's done a higher quality paper, in previous year times, it didn't seem to gel with some of its readership. I mean, there was when I remember it switching for part of the Dan Dare run, for example, and it was just too much. It was a higher quality paper, but it didn't feel like 2000 AD to some people, I think. But yeah, it's that certain colour palette, and it gave him the opportunity to have a really bright, but also bright colour. It stood out. You've got that mix of black and white and colour throughout Looking, haven't you? So.
coming back to Ellen, I'm intrigued by the idea of a comic book artist influencing somebody who's working in photography. Do you want to just explain a little bit of how that fed into what you were doing, and whether there are any sort of unique aspects to Arthur's work that have continued to be an influence on you?
Yeah, I mean, really, it was he was looking at other cultures and world building. Mm. So I really wanted to be able to take that and kind of create my own kind of universe. And having seen how he makes that, I mean, he kind of meticulously plans out the maps and often just paints these entire worlds that never get seen in the comics even. And I really loved that idea of kind of like a psychogeographic way of kind of pinning all of these places, even if you're not going to, well, in my case, photograph there, even if he's not going to draw that, he knows exactly the lay of the land in all of his work, particularly Maisel, because he's creating a completely new dimension. So I really, really wanted to kind of transfer that. And that's something that he was so seamless with in his work. It was always so well mapped out. And the one picture that's actually on one of the covers, I think it's Maisel's cover, that's just kind of like one vista of the entire place. And it's so perfect because he knew exactly what he was doing. And you rarely see that, I think. I mean, it was kind of something of an eye-opener for me.
It was interesting chatting to him about his process, because number one, he was very modest about the whole thing. Number two, whenever you kind of try and delve into it, he was almost like, well, I didn't put that much thought into it. It's almost as if he's just kind of innately drawing these things into his work.
Yeah, he does that. Whether it's conscious or not, which I think it probably is, he's just, like you say, extremely modest. There's a great kind of deal of imagination going on, and a lot of people kind of lean on heavily like lore from other comics, but he's completely just making this up as he went alongside whoever was writing. So it feels to me like he was just so uniquely gifted at completely world building. It's got a unique feeling to it. It really has.
I think Ellen's completely right. I think one of the things that may be underappreciated about Arthur's art is the way that he creates the space in the comics, the locations in the comics. I'm thinking of the first Button Man book where Harry X is under attack in the cottage, I think, in the Lake District, or anyway, and as you move between the frames, as the people are outside and Harry's moving through the house on the inside before he leaves, you get the sense that Arthur knows exactly how long it's taken him to move from one location to the other, and the way he's timing the storytelling between the panels is all based on that being a very grounded and real location that he's, you know, I don't know if he sketched the layout of it, but you really get the sense every time he moves from one location to another that is a place that, you know, that these characters are inhabiting. They're not just kind of superimposed on a landscape. Mm-hmm. They very much arrive, you know, that they're embedded within it.
One of the things that I brought up with him was the contrast in his work between stillness and action, that he has a very good appreciation of how a lack of action can be dynamic in of itself, particularly when you look at something like Button Man. There's lots of still panels in there. And Graham, I wanted to ask you about this, because back in the my dark days of reviewing comics on a weekly basis, so many superhero comics feel the need to have action at all times. You know, the conversations happening in mid-fight and all this. It's almost like there's two stories taking place.
Yeah, exactly.
How important for you is something like the concept of time, the concept of stillness in something like Arthur's work?
Well, Arthur's amazing for the way he controls the pacing of the reader. You look at something like Button Man, and even though it's a conversation, he will find other things of interest to control how fast you're reading that page. And it's so it's masterful in the way that he never loses the visual interest, but slows things down and knows how to control the eye as it goes across the page. It's he's unlike anyone else I can think of in that way.
Hmm. John, where do you think he got that from? Because are British comics and American comics, do they just have a different concept of pacing?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, there's I mean, 2000 AD aside, I mean, a lot of British comics, you're packing a lot of action. I mean, if you look at stuff written by Tom Tully, a lot from Lion Street, for example, there's a lot of action packed into three pages. And, you know, he'll sort of tell an American US 22-page strip, and it'll take the whole of one story and distill it into three pages. He was that good. And Angus Allen's the same. But I think there's a... There is a stillness to it. There is a slower pace to a lot of British comics, despite the need to be action orientated. I mean, and that possibly comes from the success of girls' comics in particular, where, as several people have pointed out, the strength of those is the characters, not necessarily the storytelling. And if you think that, you know, John Wagner and Pat Mills and several other people who went on to write action and 2080 came from DC Thompson's girls comics, and maybe that's part and parcel of that thing. I mean, look at Frank Hampson's Dan Dare. I mean, it is quite still in its storytelling, and may seem, and would now may look very old fashioned to a lot of people, even though the artwork is stunningly beautiful.
I mean, that's the extraordinary skill for a writer to have, where you're working in girls comics, which by and large were and I hesitate to use this phrase, but quite soap opera-y, you know, that it was talking heads. There wasn't necessarily an awful lot of physical drama to them. To fill that space, to make it enthralling, to make it interesting, you do have to have complete control of the pacing. And then you get an artist like Arthur Ranson who adds his own layer. And as Graham says, you know, they're completely in control of how you are physically reading a physical object.
And what was also great was you see Arthur grow across his career. You know, by the time he's done doing Button Man, he's been working for decades, and he's still getting better. And what he learns there, he takes to Maze World, and you can see that to play into what he's doing in Anderson. And he continues to grow continually with what he's doing with symbolism, with what he's doing with pacing. It's amazing to watch him.
Graham, have you read his Batman work?
Yeah, he did three issues with Alan Grant in Legends of the Dark Knight, right?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, he did a Phantom Stranger special as well, yeah.
Yes. Because Zenobacter, I think I referenced it in the interview, Zenobacter did this incredible analysis of just three panels from Tau, which was the strip that that Arthur did. And again, she goes into what we've already talked about, the incredible sense of space, the incredible sense of timing, the incredible sense of realism. And to do that in American comic, I mean, you can almost understand why he never got any more work, because do you think that some people would not necessarily been able to have computed what he was bringing to the table?
Oh yeah, I think American audiences would have been just it's the Bob Rill thing. They either would have loved it or they would have not had any idea what they're looking at, because he was such a different type of artist. And it's a shame. I feel that if he had come around, you know, even 10 years later, I think that his work would have been much more welcomed into the American market. But, you know, he's such a strange choice for Batman, which is all about dynamism. It's all about the things continually being in motion. And I think Arthur excels when he's got the space to let things breathe.
Wait, one thing I did want to talk about, and we brought it up in the interview, and there's a really interesting article online by comics critic Sarah Horrocks. Where we talk about photorealism, because Arthur very much rejects this label of that it's photorealistic. He goes, "Well, I'm not copying a photo. I'm drawing it. Just because I use reference doesn't mean that it's photorealistic." Ellen, I wonder, as a photographer, I wanted to come to you because one of the things that Sarah Horrocks identifies as one of the three key things that skills that Arthur has, there's texture, there's colour, and there's movement. And she talks about how, in a photo real style, Arthur still nonetheless brings incredible dynamism. It's not just a copy; he's actually giving movement to something that still looks really real. And I wondered what your thoughts were as a photographer who is dealing in still images, how you imbue a still image with action and dynamism and movement.
Okay, I mean, that's fair. I think actually, not so much as a photographer, but as someone who's kind of consumed many comics, I think it's actually the sense of weight. Quite often when you see someone drawing and they don't understand weight or where it falls or how it works, when you see kind of a limp, dead body kind of laying there, which often you do in, say, Maze World or anything, it's all about where kind of the weight falls and the clothes fall, and that creates in and of itself a sense of movement or a sense of it having been real. And I think actually it's just his great sense of understanding that creates the photorealism, and he really does reject that term. and I kind of understand why as well, because sometimes when you do see a photo, you realize it doesn't quite look like the reality. His is kind of hyper-real. Mm. His work is beyond a photograph. A photograph couldn't necessarily do what he's doing, and that it's very evident as a photographer looking at these, that they aren't all, you know, like inspired by photos. You can quite clearly see that he's been observing people or how they fall or how they move, and it's much more than a kind of stillness. It's kind of quite a deep understanding of physics, the way bodies fall and move, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one thing that's always struck me about the way he renders the human body is just how, I suppose, lacking in what you'd call a heroic aesthetic his figures are. So even when he was drawing Batman, you know, it wasn't a Batman that was full of muscles, that was, you know, had to be levered into his into his own suit.
A man in a costume.
It was a man in a costume,
and maybe that was what they couldn't deal with.
Well, it always reminded me of those kind of the early Superman films from the
1950s,
where it's just, you know, a man who's well built, but not a bodybuilder who's wearing a cloth suit,
and the fabric does you know, fold and
absolutely
catch, and
and so I, as you say, Ellen, he completely rejects that photorealism term. Perhaps what is a better term? Is it just realistic?
I kind of think of it as like hyperreal. I'm not sure why. There's a real kind of like breathy quality to everything that he does. It's constantly moving, but that might be, like you say, that might be the composition and the kind of, sometimes the cells are very kind of broken up and not in a kind of an obvious way. They're quite a lot of psychological design going on. Mm. And it's always kind of related to the internal feelings of the protagonist, that kind of whatever's going on with them mentally is kind of reflected out, rather than the kind of what's happening physically on the outside space.
No, but I think that's really true for Arthur's work. I mean, photorealism feels reductive for what he does, because he does reflect the emotion and the you know, in some of the stories, the spirituality of the characters in a way that is not realistic.
Yeah.
The work looks natural, but he takes it to like a supernatural place as well, that it goes beyond simple realism.
Well, you've only got to look at the 1980s, the comics of the 1980s, where the photo strip, you know, was everywhere for a few years in the mid-80s, you know, going from the Girls Comics over to the New Eagle. And, you know, they were trying...
Well, even 2008.
And indeed 2008. Yeah. They were trying to tell those kind of strips using photographs, and the vast gulf between those. And for Arthur's, you know, he's an exceptional draftsman. You know, his ability to draw things is superlative and beyond most other artists' capacity to do so.
And even beyond that, I mean, there's things in Button Man where he draws the sound effect into the panel, and his placement of the sound effects in there, or his placement of and the shape of the panels themselves, is so masterful and plays so much into how the reader feels the emotion of the story. Mm. You know, or in May's World and in Anderson, he does these amazing full page images, which are montages, which go far beyond realism because of what he's mixing together, and again speak to the emotion of the story that photos just couldn't do.
But I wonder if Arthur employs the language of film grammar in a way that is so different to others, because I'm thinking particularly, you know, sorry, reference back to Button Man again, but there's that moment where Harry looks into the aquarium And, you know, there's that wonderful tropical fish right up big in front in the frame and the rest of it. And you just wonder, did Baz Luhrmann see that and then put that into the Romeo and Juliet, you know, thing where they see each other across the tank and the rest of it. His language of how he cuts, as it were, in a story is very filmic. And I don't mean that in a reductive way, that film is better and therefore he's copying it. But he's just there's something in the nature of film grammar that I think speaks to Arthur's work.
Entirely. And Button Man is amazingly cinematic in particular. There's something about Button Man where you honestly feel like you are watching the film, or for some reason I always think Button Man is like a BBC Sunday night drama. I don't know why that I always get that, but I am always like, I feel like I saw this in, you know, in the 1990s in the BBC on a Sunday evening. But it's cinematic in a way that most comics aren't, but also in a way that many comics aspire to and fail to be, because he really does use the grammar of the cut and the grammar of cutting between similar images and finding the bridge between images and finding the bridge between scenes in a way that people just can't. And I can't say enough good things about him. His work is just masterful and speaking a language that many comics don't.
Well, that was a point that I wanted to come back to, because you mentioned it earlier, is how much comics tends to reference other comics. You see it an awful lot, you know, they're speaking the language of the comics that have gone before them. And British comics are as guilty of this as any American or European comics. But Ellen's already alluded to this. The influences that Arthur brings, whether they're religious, whether they're psychological, they are far beyond outside the realms of comics. And that gives them the feel of an extraordinary amount of depth to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the realism of what's on the page. You read it as a reader differently and in a deeper level because it has these more realistic, more outside of comics influences.
Mm. Ellen, what are your thoughts on the amount of symbolism that Arthur uses in his work?
I was thinking about that earlier in terms of, I think he's kind of borrowing from other cultures to kind of create something that would seem different to us. And the imagery, I think, probably comes directly from the writing. But I was just thinking, rather than kind of the symbolism, something that really strikes me as part of his realism that people confuse with photorealism is probably like a sense of familiarity. So when I look at his work, it feels very, very familiar to me. And I know someone just mentioned the BBC, but it also does remind me of anything that was kind of exported from the BBC in the 80s as well. Because I think that's also because he kind of rejects very glossy looking people. And I know I haven't answered your question here, but it's something I just wanted to shoehorn in, really. but all the faces are extremely real. And everyone kind of who are interacting with within the stories, they're just they're not kind of like overly kind of airbrushed or kind of beautiful looking in the classical sense. They're going to be very real people, like people that you would live next door to. And I think actually that's where the realism comes from. It's kind of like psychologically confused somewhere along the lines when you're looking at it just kind of comes across, oh, it's a photograph. But actually it's just kind of a familiarity perhaps, which is a genius thing to achieve, actually. Symbolism, I think that's probably a direct reflection from the writing, perhaps. I'm not sure. I don't want to speak on his behalf of injecting kind of symbols here and there.
John, talking about what we were talking about with the way that Arthur controls the page, one thing I've really noticed is his very innovative use of frames, and Ellen's already mentioned this about the amount of montage he uses, which is, in comics is actually really difficult to get away with, because in Sarah Horrocks's piece she talks about the framing in Mazeworld and how Arthur uses frames not just in a way of filling the page in a way that goes left to right and top to bottom, but really does control the mood and the pace of the story. So when you get characters falling off a cliff, it turns into a 5-panel grid. All of them run from the top of the page to the bottom of the page, and they give you that sense of incredible movement. And that's still a rare skill in comics, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one born of... I mean, I haven't ever seen the scripts, Alan Grant's scripts for Maze World, so I'm not sure where some of the influences will come. I mean, it's quite clear that, you know, in Maze World and in Sapphire and Steel, that Art is drawing on various... seems to be drawing on influences that he's, you know, he's he'll have watched a TV show in the case of Sapphire and Steel. But so, I mean, let's not overlook that Alan will have provided quite a lot of information, but it's like Arthur just like took the ball and ran, and you get this impression that I've just seen this comic in 2008. Here's my page now. He mentions it in the interview he did where he convinced Colin Shelbourne to change the 9-panel pages in Looking, to the dismay perhaps of some of the lesser artists on the time who Colin then made to draw in a similar style. There's always that sort of like, well, I've just seen that, but I'm going to do this. I don't know, Alan, is there a competition between his other family members who are also artists, Jerry or Jonas?
I don't know, actually. No, I'm not sure.
They all have very different styles of art, perhaps there is an element of that as well. I don't know. I'm sure that once Arthur listens to us gibbering away, he'll make his own comments on
the comments.
It's a bit like people, those stories of Stan Lee getting into the back of a cab, isn't it, when he's coming back from a speech he's made at a university, and all these kids, these teenagers are just analysing the work while he's sitting there in the back of the cab explaining what's gone into it. But I mean, either way, the work is just stunning, and as you say, whether it's deliberate or not, it's certainly drawn on some influences. And of course, he's very widely travelled as well, and I'm sure he pulls other things. You know, the fact he's been to Cambodia and to Russia and places like that on his own, and just absorbed these cultures from around the globe and put them into his work.
Ellen, as somebody who knows Arthur, and you know, we've already talked about how modest he is. What has been your experience of talking to him about his artwork, and you know, is he as reticent to analyse in private as he seemingly was in public?
Yeah, I think so. One thing I will say is that over the years I've been visiting him, he's been drawing in paint, just drawing a webcomic. And just seeing him do it, not paint the physical substance, the software, and kind of in a very methodical and precise way, he's just been making these intricate and intense comics. And he's completely oblivious of his skill. I think he believes that everyone, you know, has this potential, and it comes as easily to everybody. And that's why he's so kind of sort of beautifully dismissive of his great talent. And he kind of makes these massive, beautiful scenes on paint, and they're mind blowing seeing them. And he's just kind of doing them with his mouse, just no tablet or anything, you know, and it's a real testament to the man's skill. And yeah, you can see them on his website, and they're so interesting. Just, I've never seen anyone work like that, genuinely. He's completely operates on his own kind of skill and his own pace and his own time.
It was slightly terrifying when I went to visit him, and he pointed out that he paints with this little sort of cheap mouse that he bought.
Yeah.
God help your wrist, you know, working with something like that.
Maybe we need to send a Wacom tablet.
Yeah, nothing like that. No, it's just completely raw skill he has. Yeah.
I want to kind of round out, because we've really kind of delved into what makes Arthur unique. Ben, in no way wishing to be morbid or melancholy or anything like that, Arthur's retired now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real shame that, as Graham says, you know, hopefully there's going to be this great reappraising of his work, and his popularity is only going to grow at the very time that actually that's it now. No more comics.
We won't get more sequential art. Yeah. But in the same, you know, I very much consider him the same kind of camp as Cam Kennedy, who's alive and who's, you know, is fantastic and, you know, is a legendary artist, but whose time drawing strip work is over. I mean, that's unfortunate. I think they both created such bodies of work that there's, as you, this podcast is a testament, there's so much to delve into. Mm. I mean, what I am delighted to be able to do as a publisher, Rebellion is able to do is to do ever better editions of this material and put it out there in the world and see how it connects and see how the foreign editions do and really that they are happily around to see how the conversation develops and how the appreciation develops and you know, and I think as time passes there, you know, there will, history will kind of look back and through the lens of history you'll see the real peaks, the real artistic achievements that have come out over the last kind of 40 years and they're going to be, you know, major peaks in that.
Graham, what do you think would be the key to getting him more appreciation in you know, what we generally call mainstream comics?
Getting the work out there, first of all. Mm. You know, having Buttonman, having Maze World especially out there, I think is going to make a difference. Maze World feels like the quintessential Arthur Anson work to me. It feels like it does everything he does particularly well and in a format that is complete in and of itself. And also, I think he's just not, it's not been out there before at a time when the audience was ready, for want of a better way of putting it. Mm. And I think we're at a point now where the audience is ready. And while I get what you're saying about, you know, it's sad that it's happening now when he's not still working, he's also still around to appreciate the attention now. Mm. You know, it's better this than, you know, the more morbid thing of this happening, you know, 20, 30 years from now.
Absolutely. John, just a final thought on Arthur's career. As we've already discussed, it's unique. His style is unique. The body of work that he has is incredible. You know, we've all been full of praise for it. Are there any weaknesses you feel in the way that he's been presented, the way that he's been published in the past?
Oh, well, that's a bit... Well, that's throwing that one at me. well, I mean, I obviously haven't seen the what you're doing with Maze World. I'm really looking forward to this particular collection. I think that obviously the French... The way I would imagine that one of the best ways of presenting Arthur's work might be to look at the way the French do their albums. You know, the hardback albums with lots of sketches, and obviously looking at Arthur's website, he's got Maze World art sketches. There are some still around, and perhaps that's what you're doing. I don't know. I mean, that kind of presentation and just getting the work out there, because I mean, apart from you guys at 2000 AD, nobody's reprinted the work he did. It's, and it's great that Beatles is coming out. I'm looking forward to it. Selling gangbusters, because I'm sure it will, based on my own experience of how well it did it as a digital comics app. Hopefully that will spur you on to do the Elvis story as well, which he and Angus Allen's estate also have. And please, somebody convince the people who own Sapphire and Steel to allow you to reprint it.
that would be very nice. Ellen, final thought from you on all that we've discussed and basically Arthur's legacy. What's your overriding feel about Arthur's legacy?
Okay, two things. One's almost insignificant. I just wanted to get it out there that I absolutely love the way he renders the evening or the night. and it's so beautiful. It just reminds me of... kind of older BBC again, or kind of films like Blood on Satan's Claw or something, like kind of folkier films where during the day they'll just put a neutral density filter over the lens and it'll just kind of, all the colour will be removed. You can see it's day still, but it has that feeling of it. It feels like kind of desperately nostalgic to me, and I love it. And then you kind of see these reds still kind of popping through, all of the kind of muted blues. I think it's the way he's done that is unrivaled, and I don't think anyone's going to be touching that kind of level of skill and color for a very long time. And the second point I wanted to say is I really wonder if Alex Garland, who made Annihilation recently, was influenced by Mazeworld, because I found there's so many comparisons, and I know he's already a 2000 AD fan with Dredd and
the rest. Interesting question. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Because there are so many similarities between Mazeworld and Annihilation. And I loved Annihilation, and I just kind of want to... just take him to the pub and ask him. I just wanted to put that out there. If he hears it, I'd love to know if he was a Mazeworld fan.
Brilliant. Well, everyone, I think this has been absolutely fascinating. We've all brought something quite interesting and unique to the discussion, and I'm sure Arthur's going to be listening, and his toes will be curling at the idea that people are analysing his stuff.
Let's hope we live up to his hope on his blog that we are comics' most respected intellects in discussing his career.
No promises whatsoever. But I think it speaks of just how much respect and awe we have for Arthur and his work. You know, as I told him on the interview, it's been an incredible influence on me. It's clearly been an incredible influence on everyone else. And it's great that we've had this opportunity to chew it over. And thank you to every single one of you for taking part.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, some really good points there, Earthlitz. Thank you for joining us on the Arthur Ranson Roundtable. Hello, Arthur, if you are listening. And thank you, Earthlitz, for sticking with us. Hope you found it as fascinating as we did. If you want to pick up some of Arthur's work, having been inspired by what you've heard over the last few episodes, then do go along to 2000AD.com and pick up collections of his Anderson work. There's also the treasuryofbritishcomics.com, where you can pick up the Beatles collection that he did for Lookin. And don't forget that in the autumn, we're going to be bringing out a new edition of Mazeworld in a special collector's edition. Make sure you pre-order that when it comes up, Earthlitz, because, we're not exaggerating when we say that Mazeworld is one of the best things 2000 AD has ever published, and certainly a pillar of Arthur's career. So until next time, Earthlitz, Splendid Verthrig.
Power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.